I know it's kind of disgusting, but it's like, it's sort of like getting down to the real Madonna.
You just gotta keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
All right, I have an admittedly insane idea, but if I don't ask you this, it's just, you know, it's gonna haunt me the rest of my life.
That slice is the difference between life and death for some half-dead Bangladeshi.
Yo, you're getting me all upset here.
This is gonna be a lead pipe cinch, boys. Everybody know what to do?
We're irresistibly drawn to that almost orgiastic state created out of death and destruction. It's in all of us. We revel in it.
John, I wanted to hang out with my mom.
I've got a hangover. Who knows what that means?
Doesn't that mean you're drunk?
No, it means I was drunk yesterday.
Oh, God, why don't we exchange phone numbers and stuff? Why didn't we do that?
Because we were young and stupid.
Sounds like somebody ate a fifth of scotch for lunch again.
Not that it's any of your business, you know? But maybe.
Wow, it tastes like it's right off the grill.
You don't think it needs, like, liquid smokes?
No. I think it's perfect.
We are all way too close to this.
There's so much more to life than just being an actor.
You know all about the high-class life, don't you, Bernie?
Like what?
If we're meeting for the first time today on a train, would you find me attractive?
Who do you want to be, Mason? What do you want to do?
From Tuscaloosa, Alabama, this is Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I am Ben Flanagan. Welcome to another episode here. We're glad to have you. We're going to talk Richard Linklater's movies, films that we are huge fans of, something that we remarked about in a previous episode when it came down to Richard Linklater's filmography and career versus one of our favorites, Steven Soderbergh. But we'll leave Soderbergh out of it this time and simply appreciate the work that's been done by Richard Linklater since the early 90s, and there's been a ton of it, including his latest film, Boyhood, from IFC Films, which is currently playing in theaters, specifically here in Alabama at the Summit 16 in Birmingham. So you still have a little bit of time before it leaves theaters. So we encourage you to check it out. And later on, we're going to hear from my brother Graham as we talk about Woody Allen's latest movie, Magic in the Moonlight, which is still in Birmingham and will be playing in Tuscaloosa in a matter of a few weeks. So Corey, first off, Boyhood is out. This is a film that it took us a while to see because it took about 12 to 13 years to make this film, and it's something that was on our radars, I think, back when it was announced that Richard Linklater was going to try this out way back in, 2002, I think, is when he decided to set forth on this experiment, this journey of filmmaking that really hadn't ever been done before, other than something like, perhaps, what was it, Michael Apted had tried something like it, where he checked in at least a few years at a time on
every seven years.
Folks, and that was a documentary, I believe.
Yeah, it's a continuing series.
Yeah, and so this is a narrative that uses that format or really molds it into its own and something that is unique unto itself as a piece of art and generally as a piece of filmmaking. I think technically something that is incredibly impressive from a distribution standpoint, something that had a plan like no other film has ever had, and a relationship between filmmaker and studio and a trust that we haven't seen in a long time in this industry. So it's unique in that way. But as for the movie itself, Corey, a lot of people, I don't know that they were concerned about whether or not this would work because of Richard Linklater's stature and reputation as a filmmaker, somebody who can work efficiently and get things done rather quickly. Now, whether he can get one movie done over the course of 12 years as it's planned that way was always going to be interesting to see what we found at the end of it. And my first question here is this story that follows a young man from age 6 to age 18, a 12-year span of this person's life as he evolves from boy to young man, and his sort of life experience as he makes that transition and his encounters and relationships with his family and friends and teachers and others who mold him into the person that he becomes. It's an interesting idea, and the fact that somebody like Richard Linklater was behind it certainly encouraged me as a viewer that this could be done. And I have to ask you, I think the fact that this movie got made and there is a finished product and it got released proves that this experiment, or through the eyes of some people, this gimmick worked. The fact that we have a finished product and we have a film that we can all see now shows that Linklater at least delivered on that end. But does this movie transcend that experiment and transcend that gimmick? And does it work as a film unto itself?
I mean, I think it's kind of hard in particular with this film to separate the gimmick from the product, because the gimmick, the notion of checking in with this kid once a year, every 12 years or something, is the drive driving heart of the movie. It's something that you as a viewer are acutely aware of. It's this unspoken but incredibly evocative, inseparable part of this movie that you really can't, when we talk about gimmicks, I mean, this is not, you know, 3D. This is not putting little buzzers in the back of your seat. This is something that is just so part and parcel of this story and then ultimately ends up being so moving that it's really unlike any gimmick that I think that has been attempted in cinema history. Now, with this gimmick, of course, with this style of filmmaking comes remarkable risks. I mean, suppose Linklater shot his yearly contribution, came back the next year, and realized that he had painted himself into a narrative corner or something. Well, there's no redoing it, right? There's no going back and saying, well, we'll just get the actors back together and refilm Age 11, because it's impossible. Time moves on for the characters in this movie just as it moves on for everybody. And the really moving thing about it is that we see it over the course of an afternoon. You know, we see it over about a 2-hour and 45-minute runtime, this young man mature and transition into adulthood, or at least take those first steps into adulthood. And the remarkable thing about the movie is that I don't think Linklater painted himself into any narrative corners. I think that not only is it a truly sort of transcendent way of making a movie, but as a movie, it's also a really good movie. Just, you know, if you were to somehow to separate the method from the finished product, which I don't think you really can and I don't think you need to, I think the story is really good too. I mean, I don't think it would have the same power if it were filmed conventionally with a number of different young child actors, you know, stepping in at different stages of this character's life, because I think so much of the power of this movie comes from just seeing young Eller Coltrane in this main role here as he grows and as he evolves and as he literally changes before our eyes.
Yeah, I think methodically and artistically, this is kind of a miraculous achievement. And I'm a big fan of Richard Linklater, so I had high hopes for it, but I also assumed that it was going to work because I've generally liked everything that I've seen from him. And this, at least from the perspective of so many other people who had seen this movie before I had been considered his crowning achievement as a filmmaker and perhaps easily the best thing he had ever made up to this point. And I, you know, as someone who's a big fan of many of his movies and someone who considers those masterpieces even, that's a tall order, and there's a lot of hype going into this movie beyond that already existed from my perspective. So I think he absolutely delivered narratively and as, again, the planner and technician who sort of logistically had to execute this idea, which is far out. And where he succeeds in the biggest way here is that it doesn't really hit you that you're watching the same guy, the same actor necessarily from 6 years old to 18 years old as you're watching it. I mean, you're aware, obviously, that it's the same person when you're watching it because you have that information going into it. It looks like the same person. It sounds like the same person. And the character itself doesn't necessarily change in terms of the physical appearance that you see in other movies that use different actors. But what's so great about it is you lose sight of, again, this gimmick and this method that he set out to execute, and you get wrapped up in the story, and you get wrapped up in this character and this young man's life and the way that he changes and the person that he becomes from 6 years old to 18. And it takes a few hours or minutes or days or whatever for you to realize, wow, that took 12 years to do. And I think you don't really fully appreciate it as you're watching it. And I think the fact that you don't appreciate that is why it's so effective and how seamless the story goes from point A to point B over the course of about 2 hours and 45 minutes. And it's hard, like you said, to separate the two. As someone who watches something critically, you have to start to dig into performances, and you have to dig into sort of like what you like about the narrative and the elements of the story and plot itself. But this movie is different in so many ways, and one of those being that the story and this narrative and plot, if that even exists with this movie, it goes from one thing to another so seamlessly in a way that typical story and plot devices could never think to do because of how they made the movie. You have to think that, well, there was a lot of improvisation in terms of writing this film and directing this film and performing it because of how this young man aged and the person that he became and what he was able to do as he aged as not only a person, but an actor in the hands of Richard Linklater. And I think Eller Coltrane overall, with some rawness, vulnerability, and evolution as person and performer. I think he really knocks it out of the park, and in turn, Richard Linklater does. I think that this is one of his best movies. I'm not throwing it up there necessarily with my favorites of his work so far, but it's a one-of-a-kind experience. And I wonder, Corey, if this changes your mind at all about Linklater, the director, and we can talk about that a little later if you want to, but you know, this is somebody who doesn't necessarily swing for the fences stylistically with his films. Right. And this is a movie where he could have done that for sure, and he could have manipulated you in many ways, but he opts not to do that, and he lets the characters and story do all the work. So now, having seen this and liking it as much as you do, does it change your opinion about Linklater as a storyteller?
I mean, Linklater is a storyteller, and Linklater is a filmmaker. Is a filmmaker who, for me, has always somewhat flown under the radar. You know, I love many of his films, the Before trilogy, for example, which I think are just all three masterworks. But for whatever reason, Linklater seems to be firmly situated in a critical blind spot for me. That's not even counting a lot of the films of his that I really like and admire, like Dazed and Confused, like Bernie, like School of Rock, like even something like Me and Orson Welles, which seemingly like seven other people on the planet have seen. So it's not that I didn't think that Linklater had something like this in him, because I know he is a daring experimental filmmaker who plays not only with things like rotoscoping animation in movies like Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly, but has sort of flirted with this gimmick before returning to Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke every 9 years or so with the Before trilogy. So, I mean, this seems like a natural progression, but just to stick with it the way that he did and to turn out a finished product that is this accomplished is, you know, a considerable achievement. He certainly did something very special with this. Like you said, it's a one-of-a-kind movie. You mentioned this too, that he had the opportunity to be ostentatious, to be manipulative in particular with this movie, to make it essentially a montage of home video moments of, you know, here's prom and here's graduation and this is a birthday party and here's another birthday party. But Boyhood's not like that. It's a movie that virtually steadfastly avoids those neon light big life milestones that most of us, when we think back to our childhoods, don't really think of anyway. I don't know about you. I remember a handful of my birthday parties, but they don't jump to mind when I think of my own boyhood. They're little moments, which is why I think Boyhood at its best, though it doesn't reach the heights of this movie for me, which is probably my favorite movie of the last 25 years, Boyhood at its best is incredibly reminiscent of Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life for me, and the sequences in that film that showcase the development of that young character, Jack O'Brien, again, just comprised of little things, of little moments, of interactions that I think come together ultimately to make us who we are. One of the great things about Boyhood is that Mason Jr., the character that Ellar Coltrane plays, is not a reactive, precocious teenager. He's sullen and he's withdrawn in the way that many of us are as teenagers, but that doesn't mean he's not always noticing. And that's what Linklater observes, is Mason observing the people around him. And when he becomes more expressive and older in his late teen years, I mean, you fully understand why he is the way he is because of the people around him and the things he's experienced. And for that, I mean, Boyhood is a remarkable experience, because not only does it chart that, but it charts it in, you know, remarkable detail and with, you know, the central method of filmmaking that it does. You actually see Ellar Coltrane grow.
The milestones that you mentioned are sort of on the periphery. There are those moments like a graduation party or him seeing women in bras in a catalog, sure, or seeing a dead animal on the ground and sort of observing that moment and, you know, learning about it. There are things like that that definitely happen in this movie, unavoidable life experiences that have to be documented in the way that Richard Linklater does here. But the way this transcends the gimmick and the way that this lets you sort of escape the whole notion of this movie and how it got made are those very specific experiences and observations that Mason makes, especially as he lives right through them, particularly his relationship with his parents and, in many cases, step-parents. His relationship with his sister, too, who we can talk about in a minute, and how he takes it all in and how he doesn't necessarily let it get him down. He doesn't necessarily let it affect him in a way that is going to transform his personality and him as a human being, and how he sort of takes it in stride, learns from it. He's a smart young man, and I think Eller Coltrane is too, and I think they use that to their strength. And it's going to be hard for a lot of people to separate Mason from Eller Coltrane because, I mean, he grew up making this movie. Obviously, we have 12 years of documentation that shows that. But at the same time, we have, what, 8 Harry Potter movies documenting how those kids grew up too, physically anyway. So, I mean, and there's a connection to that universe as well with this movie, but, sure, which is really touching. But Coltrane's acting in this movie, if we want to talk about the performance for a second, because he's surrounded by really strong performances from veteran, seasoned actors who know what they're doing and deserve a lot of credit for making this investment too, along with Linklater and his crew and Coltrane. Like Ethan Hawke and like Patricia Arquette, who play his biological parents, and a lot of, again, these stepdads that come into and out of the picture. And then you also have Lorelai Linklater, who is Richard Linklater's daughter, who plays his sister in this film, this sort of bratty antagonist to Mason as he grows up. From the moment we start this movie and she's singing this stupid Britney Spears song, just tormenting him all the way until he graduates high school. But I think that his acting goes up and down, and I wonder if it's the actor's general interest or indifference to the project as it goes on. I've heard in an interview not too long ago that there was a very short period where there was this sort of period of rebelliousness from Eller Coltrane, but it didn't last very long, and there was this sort of scare the production had that he might opt out of this project midway through as he entered his adolescence. As a kid, he's so much of an extrovert early in the movie. He's so energetic, and he expresses himself, and he's loud along with his big sister. But as he grows up, he gets much quieter and way more cynical. And his life experience, it lends itself to that transformation. But the performance gets a lot quieter and less dynamic, especially during his sort of mid-teenage years as he's encountering his second stepdad in this movie. There's a scene in particular where you think, okay, well, maybe this guy isn't going to morph into the actor that they thought he would have. But soon Mason begins to come out of his shell. And as he starts a long-term relationship with a classmate, and as he finds his passion as a young photographer, we see him blossom into this full person, this one that he'll probably become for the rest of his life, or at least most of it. And Coltrane's performance, to me, really evolves at that point, particularly in scenes with his girlfriend and his mom, his dad, and his teacher, in a particularly good scene that takes place in a dark room.
I'm worried about you, Mason.
Why is that?
I'll tell you why. The images you're turning in are cool. You're looking at things in a really unique way. Got a lot of natural talent.
Thanks.
Yeah, but that and 50 cents will just get you a cup of coffee in this old world. I've met a lot of talented people over the years. How many of them made it professionally without discipline, commitment, and a really good work ethic? I can tell you, I can count it on 2 fingers. 0.
Yeah, you know, his performance does get less dynamic, I suppose, in those sort of middle teenager years. But, you know, I guess I kind of defy you to find me a teenager who, when put on the spot like that, wouldn't just sort of withdraw within themselves. And maybe that's just due to my own recent experience working with kids around that age group as a high school teacher. But even though it's not as dynamic, it still feels really natural to me.
Yeah.
That's how he would react. Because one of the things about this movie is that invariably, just because of its uniqueness, you're going to see something of yourself in this movie, whether you see yourself in Mason Jr. or, you know, one of his parents or one of the peripheral characters or his sister. And I think that relationship is portrayed in that particularly complex way that some sibling relationships are, which is, you know, they're at each other's throats in one moment and they're fine. They're totally fine with each other the next. And most of the time, it's sort of a live and let live situation where, okay, well, I'm totally fine with this other person as long as they're not, you know, screaming Britney Spears at me at 8 in the morning or something. But I guess that's why this movie works so well for me, is because quite apart from everything, it very seldom feels artificial. People enter Mason's life and they exit his life unceremoniously because that's how life is. People that you suspect are going to play a major role in your life sometimes don't stick around to do it. Or people who you don't start off having the closest relationship with end up being an integral part of who you become. And, you know, I think one of the most moving parts of this movie to me is the development, the sort of coming of age, not only of Mason Jr., but of Mason Sr., played by Ethan Hawke, who sort of grows as a man and as a parent over these years. But for me, quite apart from the sort of star of the show, so to speak, the MVP of this movie is Patricia Arquette. I think she's fantastic. And I think that that's a role and a performance that is bare and natural and just really moving in a way that actresses are seldom called upon to be. She just sort of puts it all out there. The sort of motherly, really, really exceptionally moving performance that culminates in this fantastic final scene with her near the end of the film. It's one of those things, I, like you said, mad props to Hawke and Arquette for sticking with this project, you know, all the way through. And I think they should be justly rewarded for doing so because I think they're excellent.
I agree with you. And, you know, much like many households out there where the mother is the rock of a family, Arquette is arguably the rock of this movie. She's just such a consistent presence, both in just performance and just sheer presence and convincing fashion as a mother here, and Mason's mother in particular. And it's an incredibly drawn relationship that they create here between the two of them. And what's crazy is, like, you look at these actors, like Ethan Hawke has had a lot of success over the past couple of decades, and we've been very familiar with him in sort of like the Indian mainstream worlds where he has found that success. Patricia Arquette has had less. She's done well on television, and she has done pretty well in movies, but she's somebody who I think sort of not disappeared, but worked a little less as she got a little older. But all the while, she's making Boyhood. In the past 12 years, when we haven't seen as much of her, she's giving arguably her best performance she's ever given in this film that has just been gestating for so long. So, like you said, she deserves to be applauded in a big way here. And it's just amazing to think of what the relationship between these cast and crew members must be like, having worked together like this and developed these on-screen relationships, because they are so convincing. Like you said, there are just these universal things that are going to apply to everybody who watches this movie. It's not everything that will apply to everybody, but it'll be these just individual moments and themes and experiences that you've at least experienced once or twice in your life. I mean, this movie deals with divorce. It deals with step-parents and siblings in a really realistic way that sometimes, you know, borders on drama, but in a way that's very realistic and scary. At times, there's an actor, and I don't want to give too much away about this character, but there's an actor in this movie, Marco Perella, who is outstanding in this film and kind of scary, again, in some of the most tense moments in the movie. And it's just the kind of character and person that is in your life. If you're in the same position as Mason is anyway, you know, he moves in and out of homes and cities, and people come in and out of his life, like you mentioned before. And again, these are just these things that shape someone's life. I mean, you could call this childhood, honestly. You could call it parenthood, because it doesn't just stick to Mason's perspective. You see it from his parents. You see it from, again, these step-parents and his sister and all these different characters who have an impact on Mason. He has just as much of an impact on them, too. And I think it's great that he sort of broadens that approach and tells other people's stories other than just his, because he easily could have done that and just stuck to him and gone for this manipulative approach that shined a light on these very specific and universal moments that we already know about and that we've already seen in movies, and instead sort of goes in between those and through the cracks. And I think it's incredibly successful in doing that.
And I don't know about you, but the soundtrack to this film was essentially like somebody just plucked every single mixtape and mix CD that I made from 2002 to like 2012 and just handpicked some tracks. I mean, like, there's a Cat Power song that turns up, and, you know, I just kind of froze for a minute, like, seriously, is this happening? And I said this after seeing the film, it's as if Richard Linklater called me on the telephone and said, hey man, what song should I pick to end my awesome movie? And he took my answer that I didn't give him, but I hypothetically could have.
Are you saying you deserve credit for the...
I don't deserve a thing, okay. But it's as if he read my mind.
Sure.
Because that cue just starts with the credits, and I can't even tell you. I mean, this is such a minor thing, but this movie had just had such an effect on me, and it's a cumulative effect. It's an effect that builds and builds and builds, and it's one you're not aware of until near the end of the film when you realize, oh, wait, this is almost over, because look at him. He's a man. He's got a beard. You know, you're just all of a sudden overcome with how quickly all of this moves, not only in this film, but in life. I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, being a parent of a young child and seeing this movie. I feel like it would destroy me. But, you know, all of this just overtakes you near the end of this film, culminating this fantastic final scene that just puts so neat of a bow, this Richard Linklater-tinged bow on this, the whole proceeding. And then that song kicks in. It was a transcendent moment.
Yeah.
It's one of those transcendent moments that people who love movies chase. I mean, essentially, this movie is that in totality.
Yeah, and the music that he uses, a lot of the songs are sort of used to provide a timeline for the viewer in a way, and picking music that was occurring as they were filming, perhaps. But it doesn't do it in sort of a look-at-me way. There are no graphics on the screen to indicate right. What year it is. I mean, this movie often transitions from one age to the next rather quickly and jarringly, mm-hmm. but seamlessly, too.
There he is with a different haircut. He
exactly.
Must be older.
From one scene to the next. Yeah. There's nothing gradual about it in some cases, but looking back on it, the whole thing is pretty gradual. And again, it's very natural in how it makes that progression, and it's very well done. The fear that I had going into this was, I can't just like this movie just because it did it, mm-hmm. you know, just because it filmed somebody for 12 years. You can film anything for 12 years and put it on a screen for 3 hours and say, look at what I did. Aren't I great?
Look, I took care of a ficus tree for 12 years. Here it is.
Exactly. This is much more human than that, but he did it in so much more. And it is about the life experience that we all experience, and you know, how we become the people that we become. And what I think is so great is, you mentioned that this is not a kid who is just precocious and just any other child actor. This is just that kid or mm-hmm. that person. This isn't something that they're trying to paint into something that doesn't exist anywhere else but the movies. This is a real person,
yeah.
and they don't force him to act any certain way. This is just who he becomes, and this is a very specific type of person, I guess, and somebody that we don't see on screen very often. People don't write characters like this because it's just real life, and this is just how they turned out, and these are people that we know and are friends with. And I think that this movie teaches you about how you behave towards one another, and this movie touches on bullying and how you just treat people generally in mm-hmm. very, you know, short and specific ways. But, you know, it's just a really great movie about humanity and family. I mean, there are just some really terrific moments between the kid, you know, and the things, again, these milestones that he experiences personally, like going to buy the last Harry Potter book at the midnight sale is a really touching moment that I think we can identify with.
Yeah.
And this camping trip he goes on with his dad was one of my favorite sequences mm-hmm. in the movies, where they just talk Star Wars while they're making s'mores around the campfire.
Talk about the Dark Knight.
Yeah, and there's this, you know, last man-to-man talk between Mason's senior and junior as his buddy is warming up, and this is after he's graduated, and you know, when he and his girlfriend visit his sister in Austin and just sort of walk the streets of Austin overnight, which is kind of a callback to Before Sunrise, I think, in a way.
Yeah, Linklater's done that before.
Yeah, well, there's also, as we sort of close here, and we're going to talk about our favorite Richard Linklater characters in a little while, and I hope I'm not stealing your thunder here, but there is just such a wonderful reference to one of his...
A little cameo?
Yeah, one of his first movies that he made.
I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, when it happened, I just absolutely lost it and thought, if you were going to make a reference to one of your earlier movies and characters...
With that individual.
Yeah, the best possible choice he could have made,
yeah.
And it's just fantastic.
I
and this whole movie is too. And it's still in theaters in Birmingham at the Summit, and it probably won't be for very long, but I think we both encourage you to check it out. And if you have to wait, then you have to wait, but it's a must-see in 2014.
Well, let me ask you a question before we transition into the next thing.
Sure.
If you're an Academy voter, and that's a hard mindset to put yourself into because of crazy choices they make sometimes, are you remembering Boyhood?
I don't think you have a choice.
I mean, that's kind of where I'm falling too.
Yeah.
If you're looking at the achievements of the year in film, what is more unique and more accomplished than this?
Well, I think that this is sort of the definition of achievement in film. Yeah. So how can you ignore it?
You know, we'll see. I mean, obviously, we don't know how the rest of the year is going to shake out. But, I mean, I'm in the same boat as you. I don't see how they could either.
Stanley, you are still the best in the world. I need your help.
The plot thickens.
The Catledge family are socialites in the south of France. There's a woman who has them believing she's a spirit medium. You are the greatest debunker of fake spiritualists.
She won't fool me.
Sophie looked into my eyes and told me things about me she could never have known.
I'm told she's very pleasant to look at.
She's a visionary and a vision.
I'm getting a mental impression. Are you from the Orient? The Far East?
Considering you are Wei Ling Su, that's pretty damn impressive.
You are a very clever little humbug.
I think you'll trick me into showing you how I deceive people.
Stanley doesn't believe in spiritualists. He thinks you're all scoundrels. She's quite likable, even if she is a fraud.
My mental impressions are cloudy.
Are they cumulus clouds or cirrus?
You're making fun of me.
Mr. Tavernier is rather obnoxious.
But he's not entirely unappealing.
I understand you're holding a seance tonight.
The planets are in alignment.
Now I will summon the unseen world.
Give us a sign.
The more I watch her, the more I'm stumped. Could she be real? I'm beginning to question my own common sense.
You've always been so certain about the world, and I've always tried to teach you that we don't know.
Tell me something about my Aunt Vanessa's colorful past.
I see a member of Parliament.
Go on.
A love affair.
You cannot possibly know this.
I'm overwhelmed, Sophie. I never dreamed you could look this beautiful.
I believe that the dull reality of life is all there is, but you are proof that there's more. More mystery, more magic.
They're gonna die!
Run!
My aunt used to bring me here as a boy. The roof opens up and see the universe. It's menacing.
You find that menacing? I'd say it was very romantic.
We're joined now by my brother Graham Flanagan, all the way from New York City, where he and I saw Woody Allen's latest film, Magic in the Moonlight, at the Angelica Theater, I believe it's called, or Film Center, one of the two, anyway, in the Soho area of New York City. And it was a magical experience, I know, for the both of us, because we saw a Woody Allen film in New York City, which is always a great experience. And I think it's the third or fourth time that I've done that and had the privilege of doing. And I'm going to try to not let that glaze my eyes over on what I thought of this movie, because I feel like I've let that happen before. And I think Graham and I probably share this thought about the movie, that it's really one of, to me, Woody Allen's strongest movies in a long time. And I put it in the same category personally in the latter part of his career as Blue Jasmine and as Match Point and as the horrifically underrated by everyone, but particularly Corey Kraft, my co-host here, Cassandra's Dream. This falls in line with that. So it touches on topics that Woody Allen obviously has many times before, but the film that I was reminded of most, Graham, tell me if you agree with me, is Midsummer Night Sex Comedy from 1982. And the character that I thought about most often during this, when you associate it with Colin Firth's character in this movie, is Jose Ferrer's Leopold, who throughout that film tries to sort of put a damper on this thought of ghosts, little spirits, or pixies being a part of our reality. He has a quote in the movie that says, "Nothing is real but experience, that which can be touched, tasted, felt, or in some scientific fashion proved." And that's a theme that he explores throughout Magic in the Moonlight, this latest romantic comedy starring Colin Firth as a similar character, this comedy about an Englishman brought in to help unmask a possible swindle from a mentalist, so to speak, played by Emma Stone in the south of France. And of course, as is the case with most Woody Allen films, personal and professional complications ensue, along with hijinks. So, Graham, I expressed how I felt generally about this movie walking out of that theater in New York, and that has seemed to resonate with me ever since I've been back here in Tuscaloosa. I feel like you felt the same way, but how do you feel now?
I still feel the same way. Right now, it's my pick for my favorite movie of the year so far, which is a great feeling, you know, this late in Woody Allen's career, when you can say that. I'm saying that objectively because there have been a lot of great movies so far this year. I absolutely agree, and I think that the strongest aspect of this movie is the world that Woody Allen has created, and the time and place that it's set, and the characters that inhabit this world. I think it's wholly unique, not only for him, but for movies that are made this day and age. You just don't see very many movies set in this period. And to your point about Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy, which is one of my favorite Woody Allen movies and highly underrated, is in that movie, he makes it very clear that these characters are living in a world of magic by the end of the film, when sort of the woods kind of come to life. But in this, it's a mystery up until much later in the movie as to whether or not the potential for magic is real, because Colin Firth's character is at first very skeptical, certain that this woman is a phony, that she doesn't have psychic powers. But then he starts to wonder as to whether or not he might be wrong when he can't disprove what she's doing. And as a viewer, I kind of allowed myself to wonder as well, along with his character. And Woody Allen was very effective at creating that sense of intrigue and mystery. And in the end, I really enjoyed his message, which some might read as cynical, but I was listening the other day to someone talking about Nietzsche saying that beauty is the only truth in life, something along those lines. And I might be misquoting the line, and I might even have the philosopher wrong as well, but I'm not that smart. I think that that is sort of echoed in this movie at the end, is that the message is that the only real truth is love and beauty and enjoying and experiencing life while you can. And so I think that message rung true with me. It's one of the best-looking movies and best-designed movies in terms of just all of the aesthetics that it contains that I've seen from Woody Allen. And like you said, up there with some of his strongest work to date, including last year's Blue Jasmine, including Midnight in Paris from 3 years ago.
So, Corey, as I read on your Facebook page or wherever you ramble on these days, I noticed that you weren't a huge fan of the Colin Firth character here. So why don't you, like Stanley Crawford in this movie, bring us brothers here and fans of this film back down to earth?
That's fine. You know, if I'm Colin Firth in this movie, you're Hamish Linklater and Graham is Jackie Weaver. And I'm willing to play that role. The first 20 minutes of this movie, you know, and I never go into a Woody Allen movie with low expectations. You know, there's always something that I get out of these movies, even the movies that I don't particularly like that much. There's always a lot to enjoy, but the first 20 minutes of this movie were really trying me, because it's nothing but a series of scenes that felt particularly strangely for Allen, coming off of what I think is one of his best movies in a really long time, Blue Jasmine, and one of his smartest written movies in a really long time. These opening 20 minutes are filled with scenes of characters walking onto screen and saying, "This is who I am. This is what I do and what I believe about the world that we inhabit." And none are more irritating than Colin Firth's protagonist here. Frankly, this is probably the most frustrated I've ever been with an Allen protagonist, I think, in his long, storied career. And people point to movies like Celebrity with Kenneth Branagh in that movie, or even Melinda and Melinda with Will Ferrell, and these are all these Woody Allen impressions. I don't think Firth is doing a Woody Allen impression. I think he's mistreating some Woody Allen dialogue, but I don't think he's actually doing an Allen impression. I just think he's frustrating and irritating. This is probably the single most irritating performance of the year so far. And frankly, I think, you know, you compared him to Jose Ferrer in Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy, and I think that's a good comparison, but Jose Ferrer in that movie is kind of an antagonist. And I really didn't enjoy spending so much time with cranky old Colin Firth in this movie and having that be the entrance into the movie. I thought it was extremely frustrating, and he's just not a likable guy. I don't need my characters to be likable, but I know that Woody Allen's setting up some sort of wacky romantic comedy farce thing here, and it doesn't do anything for me because I don't buy into it.
I think that it's absolutely intentional that he's supposed to be a character that's not likable, especially in the first part of the movie. He's supposed to be completely sure of himself, supposed to know everything and understand everything, and basically there's nothing that can challenge his view of the world. I think that's the point. And yes, he does come off as a jerk. But then when he starts to sort of question himself, that makes him more likable in my opinion, because I think Woody Allen's trying to say, sometimes you should question yourself. Sometimes you should second guess your own beliefs, your own principles, and what you think to be true. And I think his character becomes more likable. And in the end, you feel bad for him because he kind of got away from his principles and was being fooled while doing it. And you feel bad for him, and that makes him a sympathetic character. But of course, at the beginning, I agree, Corey, he doesn't start off that way, but that's the arc of his character. I think that he changes from the beginning and to the end of the movie, that there's a major change in him.
You know, I don't disagree with that in theory. I think it suffers in execution, though, because, again, the setup is just all of these exclamatory sequences of characters announcing themselves in a way that Alan very obviously and certainly knows how to do much better, because he's done it much better in many, many other films. There's something, frankly, that seems frustratingly amateurish, and I hate to use that word, obviously, for a seasoned filmmaker, but it's the same accusations that are often leveled against his movies. Critics go into these movies and they say, yeah, do another draft next time, Woody. And this is honestly one of the first times I've agreed that this movie is a draft away, that it's underbaked, because it just doesn't come together. After those first 20 minutes, it's never that bad again, but it never takes off for me either.
For me, these lines and these declarations that these characters are making early on that introduce themselves and establish their beliefs are the most decidedly written and developed lines I think Woody Allen has written in some time. They feel so polished and so well delivered by a seasoned actor, especially like Colin Firth. But what I like so much about his character early on and how curmudgeonly he is and how comfortable he is in his philosophy and his beliefs in science and there being no cosmic universe, magic, pixies, or anything of the like, how sure he is and how steadfast he is in those beliefs. In the first scene, he begins to explain himself, suggests to you how hard he's going to crack later in the movie at some point, and his entire foundation is just going to come crumbling down. And I think that that is what Woody Allen is trying to communicate with this character, how strongly he is in his ways and what he thinks is true about the world and about science and about these things he knows not to be the truth. The way he so firmly establishes that about himself, it's obviously foreshadowing how hard he's going to fall. And Colin Firth is one of his best protagonists in a while. And, you know, you talk about this Woody surrogate, and maybe he is playing this sort of Woody Allen character, and he is communicating these ideas about the world and about there being no afterlife or no magic in this tangible world and empirical existence that we live in. But I think he flows right on through it, and he does it in a way that perhaps only Colin Firth could. I mean, we're familiar with what he can do and his skill set, and I think he's perfectly suited for this character, again, who is intentionally curmudgeonly. So if you're frustrated by this guy and about his outlook on the world and his behavior, then I think that they were probably successful in painting this character as intentionally as they were.
Yeah, but you think back to something like Sweet and Lowdown, which has a very similar character at the center of it, and Sean Penn's sort of pretentious, rakish, but ultimately charming jazz guitarist, Emmett Ray, in that film. The key word there is charm, because I don't think Colin Firth pulls that off in this movie. He's just irritating. He's not irritating while simultaneously being charming.
Well, his intellect is powerful, and I think that that is what probably smooths himself over ultimately with people and why they accept him into their households and into their lives, is because they're with a man who has proven his greatness as somebody who sort of has conquered the trickiness of his profession. You know, he is out to disprove everything about the universe that he has thrived in as a professional, which I think is a great dynamic for the character to have. But once he encounters this Emma Stone character, it's just a matter of time before he starts to, again, fall for it and give in to this idea that things exist beyond reality and beyond what we have always known. And I think that once he begins to sort of succumb to her charade from his perspective at one point, that's when the movie really takes off. But following the opening credits, like most Woody Allens do, it had already started to take off, because I love this character from the moment he starts speaking. I believe in his performance as this jerk who, again, is so set in what he believes and will not be proven otherwise. And, you know, and it may be predictable plot. Maybe it's something that, you know, you see coming in a weak way. I disagree. I'm looking forward to that moment where he finally cracks. And I think that it's convincingly done through Woody Allen's incredibly funny and polished and very charming writing, and also Colin Firth's performance, which I think is really strong.
Yeah, just didn't we like this guy so much that it's funny how we see different things in different movies, and even a filmmaker that we respect as much as Woody Allen, you know, for example, I mean, Cassandra's Dream continues to do nothing for me, and I guess this is another one that we can add to that list of movies that just don't really ever take off, because this certainly never did. And by the time Emma Stone is introduced, and I think she's fine in this movie, but you know, by the time her character really starts asserting herself, I don't know, I just don't think it does much.
Graham, you had mentioned the world, you know, that he builds with this movie. The look obviously is great, and again, the production design is on par with a lot of the period work that he's done. This is actually his first period film, I think, since Curse of the Jade Scorpion. So it had Midnight in Paris is a contemporary set film that, you know, goes in the length of the film. Yeah, purely a period piece. This is that one. So I think it looks fantastic. But these supporting characters that are on board here, you'd mention Hamish Linklater and Jackie Weaver, and you have these other actors who I think are fantastic, particularly Linklater, who's really funny, gives a great comedic performance as this, you know, sap rich boy who's just completely smitten with the Emma Stone character and spends the movie courting her.
We're just all about people named Linklater on this podcast.
Apparently. I think he's great, and I think everybody else is. I think that the only character and performance that was lacking here, and I think that it could be something that was lacking in the writing too, is the Marcia Gay Harden character. I mean, you have an Oscar-winning actress here at your disposal, and this character who sort of disappears for the rest of the movie relatively early on and doesn't really play a part in how this plot plays out. But in retrospect, I'm not sure that it necessarily needed it, and you may not have needed the character in general, but this movie, Graham, has a bit of a twist that I don't think we should necessarily give away that really was effective for me and does a number on the Colin Firth character, and you see this transformation go back and forth and a really nice arc and development of a new original Woody Allen character, even though he's revisiting themes that we're familiar with in the film that we mentioned before and others.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a mystery, and you either see it coming or you don't, or you're surprised. Me personally, I kind of let myself become, and I'll use a wrestling term here, a mark. I wanted to kind of get in the mindset of the Colin Firth character and find out what happens as he did without trying to second guess or predict too much. And when that happened, you know, I was surprised and delighted about the turn of events. And I thought that it basically brought home Woody Allen's message in this movie, which is, as I said earlier, the meaning of life, which ends. Well, I think a great line in the movie is that we're all born innocent, yet we all have a death sentence. You know, we all go through this and it's going to end and just kind of go dark. So the only thing we can do is enjoy beauty, enjoy love, seek out beauty. And basically the key to this movie, you're mentioning the supporting characters, but the key to this movie is Emma Stone. You have to fall in love with her. If you really get this movie, you have to fall in love with her as a moviegoer. You have to at first be a little wary and skeptical about her, but then you have to give in. You have to think she's beautiful. You have to be charmed by her little habits, her eating habits, her wardrobe. That's the triumph, the key central triumph of this movie, is that Woody Allen cast her so perfectly, directed her so perfectly, and to her credit, she gave an amazing performance where you don't know what to think. She might be real, she might be phony, and that's all due to her, the way she looks, the way she acts, the way she sounds, the things she says. That, to me, is the heart and soul of this movie. And real quick, I just want to mention, in terms of supporting characters, I don't think that any of them shine as brightly as Eileen Atkins, who plays Colin Firth's aunt, who I think has an Oscar-worthy scene towards the end of the movie when she's playing solitaire and having a dialogue with Colin Firth without even making eye contact with him. It's just an amazing performance that I hope gets remembered around Oscar time.
Yeah, and another brilliantly written scene there by Woody Allen.
I actually really like that scene.
Yeah, and she's great. And she's great throughout the movie, too.
Yeah,
sort of
this she is really good.
Foil to her nephew, Colin Firth. But Graham, I think the line that you were referencing earlier is where Stanley says, "You're born, you commit no crime, and then you're sentenced to death." Yeah. And then there's another one later in the movie where Stanley says, "I can't forgive you. Only God can forgive you." Where Sophie says, "But you said there is no God." And he says, "Precisely my point." And right. This movie touches on heavy themes, but does it with such a light touch in a way that we've seen from Woody Allen. But he does it in a way that makes you feel like he's still in the prime of his career as a writer and as a director. I think that this movie flows incredibly well, much like Blue Jasmine did, his previous film, which was one of his better edited movies I've seen in a long time that included flashbacks and dialogue. dialogue that was written at a pace that you found earlier in his career. And again, I think the pace is so crucial here in the performance and the way that you have to deliver lines like that, lines that are, you know, intellectually advanced in a way, but you have to deliver them comedically and lightly to keep this thing a comedy. Because, I mean, when you're talking about there is no God and you have a death sentence and you make references to the Grim Reaper and the realities of the world and the real truths and how science rises above all, that sounds heavy when in actuality in this film, it's incredibly funny and he treats it again with such a light touch that makes you feel good to watch his movies again. Something that we often talk about with these Woody Allen movies is we sit there through the opening credits and, you know, you start out with a blank slate every time with these Woody Allen movies. There's nothing like sitting through those credits, which are the same every time. You get the black screen, the white titles, and the old jazz or opera music that Woody Allen picks. And from that point on, anything can happen. Sometimes you're dealt a bad hand here, and we have been dealt that with a handful of movies and late in his career. But luckily, as of late, he's hitting home runs to me. And I'm a longtime fan of his entire filmography. And I can acknowledge when he, I hate to use the term stinker, but the ones that I think are stinkers really are stinkers. But in this case, I think he's hit another home run right there again with Blue Jasmine and Cassandra's Dream and Match Point. So, Corey, you know, I'm sad you don't feel the same way, but, you know, to me, I just don't understand how you can sit there and not enjoy this movie. And if it's because primarily of the Colin Firth character for being curmudgeonly, then I don't know what to tell you, man.
It's just the lack of, I don't know, charm or interest sort of curmudgeonly. But look, it's not as if I'm not going to see this movie again on Blu-ray, because obviously I'm going to. I always give these movies more than their fair shake. I always see them multiple times. And of course, I'll check this one out again. But look, I mean, the good thing about Woody Allen, and sadly, this won't keep going forever, but at least for the time being, he's still cranking these out one a year. So even if you don't like one, you've always got next year to look forward to. And next year's Woody Allen movie features not only Emma Stone of this film, but also Joaquin Phoenix, an excellent actor. So we've got that to look forward to. And maybe as we were with Blue Jasmine, we'll once again be on the same page.
What's your take on Emma Stone's not only performance, but sort of what her character does in this movie and how that, you know, relates to, you know, Woody Allen as a writer and director?
Just knowing what I know of Woody Allen, I knew exactly where it was going. I mean, there's something that the character does about halfway through the movie that totally tips off where that character arc is going. And, you know, Woody Allen has, and I'm trying to dance around this as delicately as possible, he's not always been so fervently tied, I guess, to one particular worldview or another. I feel like late in his career, his sort of style of filmmaking has become so firm and his worldview with it has become so firm that the outcome of this was never really in doubt. But, you know, like I said, I think she gives a fine performance. I feel like in a lot of her scenes, she's relying on Colin Firth to sort of play off of. And, you know, I'm sorry, I just don't think he's very good in this movie. It's not a performance that ever worked for me. And I don't think her scenes really took off in the way that they might have against somebody else. But I think she's a really good actress, obviously. I think she's done a lot of good work. And,
you know, speaking of one element of Woody Allen's worldview, we obviously know that he has built a reputation, or at least people think he has a reputation, of casting these older male protagonists opposite younger women as love interests. And that, again, is sort of the case with Magic in the Moonlight, where you have a considerable age difference between Colin Firth and Emma Stone. And I gotta say that it's definitely noticeable, and you wonder why in this case there has to be such an age difference, but I can't see the film replacing either of these actors. I think that they each give really good performances, and I wouldn't replace either of them with the respective age-appropriate counterpart to the characters. And, you know, again, it's a noticeable thing watching this movie, and I don't really understand the choice outside of it just being another Woody Allen movie where he does this, but the actors are so good that it's forgiven. So anyway, that about does it for Magic in the Moonlight. Graham, we want to thank you. Thanks for showing us around up there recently and taking us to that theater where we saw it. Let's do it again sometime soon. And if it's Magic in the Moonlight, then we'll just leave Corey at home. And we appreciate your time, though.
Yeah, I mean, Corey, I would hope that you would be up here next year when we get, you know, when the Providence-based Woody Allen movie comes out and we can all go and see it together. That would be amazing. It would be a huge thrill for me. I read that on the set of the movie a couple of weeks ago, they had an incident where a guy somehow got close to the set and got into a verbal altercation and was throwing furniture around. So I don't know too much about the movie, but it sounds like the shooting portion of it has been pretty interesting.
Are you sure that wasn't Joaquin Phoenix who was doing that? It wouldn't surprise me, right? Anyway.
I just did a Google News search for Woody Allen today just to see if there's any news about him, and that's what came up. So yeah, you never know with him.
All right, Graham. Well, we appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Still there? Still there? Still there?
So let's talk about Richard Linklater's greater filmography, and we can include Boyhood here, Corey, but I want to talk about, since we're seeing his first movie since, what was his last one? I can't recall. Before Midnight, okay, that came out last year, mm-hmm. which was the culmination, perhaps, of this series where we revisit these characters. Maybe we will again, who knows, but there are three of those movies, and now we have Boyhood, which is another fantastic Richard Linklater movie. He's made 16 feature films that have a pretty solid array of characters, and I want to sort of pick out our favorites, our five favorite Richard Linklater characters from throughout his entire filmography. And as you and I were talking here, and as you mentioned in our discussion before, Richard Linklater isn't a filmmaker you necessarily think about all the time and doesn't necessarily have films or characters that make this a very easy list to make. This is one that you have to sort of sit down, look through the filmography and really the characters within that filmography and sort of come up with this list of five. For me, you know, it's relatively easy. Again, you mentioned the term off mic here, Linklater 101. There's this handful of movies that everybody knows about and characters within those that everybody knows about that would probably make this a relatively easy list to make if you weren't thinking too hard about it.
Sure.
But let's dive right in. And that may happen just as a warning to people, but it's only because those films are great and those characters are great.
Yeah, I'll start off with my first pick, which is a character from Boyhood. You know, as I said, I think Patricia Arquette is sort of the anchor of this movie, but I think I most responded to the character development, the arc of Mason Sr., played by Ethan Hawke, who is, in the first part of the film, in Mason's early childhood, flighty and irresponsible, driving a ridiculous sports car and sort of blowing into town, you know, once in a blue moon and becoming only nominally a part of his kids' lives. As time goes by, though, Mason Sr. settles down. He moves out of the apartment with his musician roommate. He remarries and becomes at least more of an adult than he has been previously in the film. I think it's as interesting and as moving of a character arc as his son's is in many ways. And by the last scene that he's featured in, I mean, he's gone through just as much of a journey and almost grown up just as much, though in a completely different way.
Absolutely. That's a great pick.
We got another one, huh, fellas? Whoa, guys. You wouldn't mind if I went first there, would you? Is that all right? It's kind of a personal thing between me and this little piece of shit here. So, we meet again, huh? Y'all hear this little motherfucker's mom pulled a shotgun on me this afternoon? Fucking bitch. You haven't had any licks yet, have you?
Hmm? No.
Woo! Another cherry, boys. But get the fuck off this wall. I would like to dedicate this first lick to your mother. Fuck her. Not yet. Oh. What the fuck?
My first one is from the film Dazed and Confused, and this is going to be an easy one to pick from because there are a million great characters in that movie.
You could do five from that movie.
Yeah, easily. And I fear that we're going to come back to this movie later in this list, on my side anyway. But it's the character Fred O'Banion, played by Ben Affleck. Yeah. This is this upperclassman asshole in high school that everyone came across at one point or another.
And he's like a career upperclassman,
yes,
which is hilarious.
hilarious.
This really might be Ben Affleck's best performance.
And I don't know about that.
Well, I don't mean to take a shot at him because it came so early in his career, but because I was about 9 when this movie came out, I can't recall what people said about the young performances in this movie, but I guess if it came out today, people would definitely single out Affleck's performance and label him as someone to watch for in the near future, and with good reason. I think this guy is over the top. He's a bit cartoonish at times, but his arc is so satisfying. It's one of the best full circle moments of the film, one that you hope would pay off as soon as you met this character early on. And it's really popular now to ridicule Affleck as an actor because of some choices he made about midway through his career, but he's so great in this and really makes you hate this O'Banion character like a great actor should. And I think it's one of his best performances, if not his best.
Well, my next choice is the object of his torment. Mitch Kramer is played by Wiley Wiggins, the hapless new freshman who O'Banion sets his targets on and seeks to beat with an inch of his life. There's something really appealing about this character of Mitch Kramer, who is the dweeby adolescent that I feel like most of us were, or at least felt like we were at various times, you know, in young adulthood.
Yeah, and I'm sort of nervously grabbing the ridge of my nose as you're talking about this. So.
I mean, all he wants to do in this last night of school documented in Dazed and Confused is make his mark, become friends with some older kids, make a good impression, and be seen as a team player, and also to not die at the hands of O'Banion, who is making it somewhat difficult. But there's something really appealing, really natural, and just gangly about Wiley Wiggins in this film that I think make him, I guess, the more natural, the character that you gravitate toward identifying with. You know, you also have Jason London in that movie, Randall Floyd, and you have, of course, well, I don't want to steal your thunder, but plenty of other characters to identify with. But for some reason, Mitch is the guy that I always go toward.
Well, and the movie's kind of seen through the eyes of this character at times. I mean, there's plenty of time the movie doesn't spend with him, with these older characters, especially as they're sort of driving through Texas. But it's a great character, and he's the one I think that easily people our age, as we saw this movie, can most easily identify with, for sure. And it's a really good performance from a young actor, Wiley Wiggins, who would later appear in Waking Life.
Yeah, he's in Waking Life. I think he's in a couple other things, other Linklater movies.
Talk to me. Samantha, how was your week? I don't know, Dad, it was kind of tough. Billy and Ellen broke up, and Ellen's kind of mad at me because she saw me talking to Billy in the cafeteria. And you remember that sculpture I was working on? Well, it was a unicorn, and the horn broke off, so now it's a zebra, okay? But I still think I'm going to get an egg, right? Mason, how was your week? Well, Dad, you know, it's kind of tough. Joe, he's kind of a jerk. Actually, he stole some cigarettes from his mom. He wanted me to smoke them, but I said no because I knew what a hard time you had quitting smoking, Dad. How about that? Is that so hard?
Dad, these questions are kind of hard to answer.
What is so hard to answer? About what sculpture are you making?
It's abstract.
Okay. Okay, that's good. See? That's I didn't know that. I didn't know you were even interested in abstract art.
I'm not. They make us do it.
Your first pick is my next pick. It's Mason Evans Sr. in Boyhood. Ethan Hawke's performance here. This deadbeat dad who tries to do right by his kids before it's too late. One of Linklater's most flawed but ultimately well-meaning characters yet, I think. A guy who screwed up big time and still might a few more times before it's all said and done, but someone who realizes how much he loves his kids and at least makes an effort to raise them right in his allotted time anyway, you know, on weekends and a few times during the week in summer. Time. Hawke tends to lean on this technique where his characters feign enthusiasm and kill their counterparts with kindness and like extreme sincerity. I think he does that with most characters he plays now, lately anyway, in the last 10 years or so of his career. And while I still really like Ethan Hawke, it's overkill sometimes. And here I think it works perfectly. And this is something he obviously has developed over the course of the 12 years that they shot this movie. But I think his sincerity is totally earned and genuine in one of his best performances overall here in this movie. And I mentioned the scenes like the camping trip that they take, and again this last scene that they share together at this bar shortly after his graduation. And you mentioned that Mason Sr.'s growth is almost as apparent as Mason Jr.'s is. I mean, this is a guy who was this man child, like you said, who's driving this GTO around and just really has no sense of his place as a father or an authority figure in these children's lives. But like you said, he settles down, and that slowly but surely grows, and he realizes his responsibility responsibilities. Yeah. But I respect the character because he makes an effort relatively early on, even though he's required to do so. And, you know, he has to pay child support and he has to, you know, do right by court order, or at least by his ex-wife, Patricia Arquette here, who has no time for him early on in this movie. But I think it's one of his best performances to date, and definitely one of Linklater's movies.
Yeah, he's really good in it. My next pick, a more obscure sort of side character. Well, it's not obscure. It's from Linklater's most financially successful movie to date, School of Rock. Not Jack Black's overbearing Dewey Finn, but the hapless, continually put upon Ned Schneebly, played by screenwriter Mike White. I like Mike White as an actor a lot. I like him as a writer too, but there's something about his continual portrayal of just sad sack losers, for lack of a better term, and I don't think he would disagree with that, that's both really like kind of partially upsetting, but also simultaneously just super hilarious, as is the case here with his reformed death metal rocker turned doormat for Sarah Silverman, who sort of provides the catalyst for Jack Black's character's transformation into actually decent substitute teacher, at least as far as rock and roll is concerned.
Dude, I've been mooching off you for years, and it's never been a problem until she showed up. Just dump her, man.
Yeah, well, if you don't come up with some money, she's gonna dump me. She's fed up.
Really? Because that would be a good thing. She's a nightmare.
Come on! I may never have another girlfriend. I mean, just come on! Come up with some money, please! Please!
Okay, for you. Not for her, man, for you.
I really like that movie. That's a movie that I saw again for the first time in years, pretty recently. It's a movie that is kind of looked at by my students as sort of this family movie classic now, to which I say, yeah, that's good. This is a good choice for that. It's so much better than so many of the movies that we grew up with, and it's still really entertaining.
Yeah, I love the callback to his days as a metal rocker where he like puts the Polaroid in his face and you see him made up, and that's a really great moment. And Sarah Silverman's also really great.
She's great
in that too. That's a good pick. My next pick is from Before Sunrise, which is probably a top three Linklater movie for me and my favorite of that trilogy. It is The Helpful Austrians on the Bridge.
Nice.
Played by, and I'm sorry for murdering this pronunciation, Carl Bruckschweiger and Tex Rabinowitz. Now, these are these friendly gentlemen that Jesse and Celine meet on the bridge in Vienna, who sort of gently break the ice between these young lovers who've just agreed to do something crazy and spontaneous by getting off of a train and spending the night walking the city together. And these two are just totally good-natured and start things off with this harmless joke about American tourists who can't speak the language of the country that they're visiting, but they're really kind to this couple and even invite them to this amateur play about a diseased cow and communism. But again, it's an icebreaker that sets their story into motion right off of the train as they wander into Vienna and encounter similar characters who end up shaping this relationship that would span a couple of decades and two more movies. And it's just a great way to start that movie and that sort of one night vacation off. This guy saying, "I am the cow," as they walk off, and then they realize later that they forgot to go to their play as they're on the Ferris wheel. So that's a great character.
Well, what can you say about those movies too? Just fantastic.
Okay, great. Well, what's the name of this boy?
It translates as bring me the horns of Wilmington's cow. Yeah.
I'm Wilmington's cow.
Okay.
All right. We'll
great.
Try to be there. Will you be there?
Yeah, we'll try.
I'm the cow.
Goodbye.
My next pick, one of the most over-the-top characters in Linklater's filmography and a character that you just wouldn't believe if the film weren't completely true. I'm talking about Jack Black's portrayal of Bernie Tita in Bernie, the fact-based true crime comedy that is just, it's just the sort of story that you have to see to believe. And Bernie Tita is a flamboyant, super religious funeral director in a small Texas town who starts a close relationship with a mean elderly widow played by Shirley MacLaine that evolves into, well, something totally different and takes all sorts of other directions that I'll tread lightly around. Needless to say, Bernie never outwardly shows a sinister side, though he is accused of having one. And Jack Black, I mean, I think this is the best he's ever been in anything in this film. Just inhabits this character so totally and so fully, and just makes this a really special performance in a movie that I think is still sadly and really regrettably underseen.
Oh, please, Bernie, touching all those cold, bloated bodies, please. Don't you think you were meant to do something more?
No, Mrs. Nugent, it isn't bad at all. Their souls are already with the Lord by the time I'm involved. It's just my way to serve and show respect for the lives they led and comfort all the loved ones that they leave behind.
Well.
And someday, if I'm lucky, many, many years from now, I will give you such a beautiful funeral with all the roses in East Texas. I know it'll be the event of the season in Carthage.
It's great. It's really great. And it's one of those that kind of flew under the radar. I think Jack Black got a Golden Globe nomination for it. But, you know, you had to kind of like look up as even a fan of Richard Linklater and think, oh, wait, he's got a new movie out. Who knew? And that was sort of peripherally part of the McConaissance, so to speak, as
he's
Matthew McConaughey has
too.
A supporting. Yeah, he's got a supporting performance. But Jack Black is really fantastic in it. And Jack Black is actually my next pick here. And it is the overbearing Dewey Finn from School of Rock. It's an easy pick. Yeah. You know, because, I mean, he's one of the faces of Linklater's filmography with this movie. This is probably the most popular movie other than maybe Dazed and Confused that he has made. And I think rightly so. Like you said, it's good that kids are watching this movie and that people are embracing it. And it's becoming this sort of cult kids classic that I hope families show their children because it's so good natured. And other than his performance in a movie that I love, Nacho Libre, and maybe Bernie too, I'd probably consider this his best overall performance. And I think Linklater manages to sort of simultaneously harness and unleash Jack Black's personal touch of manic energy that could easily go off the rails in the wrong hands, especially on this project where he's surrounded by this cast of inexperienced children and child musicians, really, who've never set foot on a film set. And I just wonder, what other actor would you trust around a room full of adolescents other than an overgrown one like Jack Black? He's just this ball of charisma and positivity and good intentions mixed with that lovable screw-up archetype he finds himself typecast as throughout his career. But what could be characterized as a sort of paint-by-numbers, feel-good, unorthodox teacher inspires his students movie, it wins you over primarily because of Jack Black's merciless optimism and musical sensibilities that really actually thrive in this PG setting. And who knew, too? Because, I mean, his musical background is from Tenacious D, which is this incredibly R-rated, profane project that, you know, let loose in this world could cause a lot of trouble, but I think he really reins it in as much as he needs to and gives a great performance, and the movie stands on his shoulders.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Did you show up in Vienna that December?
Did you?
No, I couldn't, but did you? I need to know, it's important to me.
Why, if you didn't?
Well, did you? Oh, thank God you didn't.
Well, thank God, like, thank God you didn't. I mean, thank God I didn't and you didn't. I mean, one of us had showed up there alone, then that would have sucked.
I know. I was so concerned with that. I always felt horrible about not being there, but I couldn't. You know, my grandma died a few days before, and she was buried that day, December 16th.
She died that day. The one in Budapest?
Yes. You remember that?
Yeah, I remember everything.
Of course, it was in your book. But anyway, oh, so. I was about to fly to Vienna, you know, and we heard the news about her. And, of course, I had to go to the funeral with my parents.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
I know. You weren't there anyway. Wait, why weren't you there? I would have been there if I could have. I made plans and you better have a good reason. What? Oh, no. No, you were there, weren't you? Oh, no. Oh, that's terrible.
So my last pick is sort of the indisputable number one, and it's a total cheat, and I'm sorry, but there's no way to do this any differently. I mean, you know where I'm going with this. Sure. You cannot separate Jesse from Celine in Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight. Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, they are these characters. I mean, I know they're not, but we visited these characters every 9 years for three movies, and you know, we start with sort of the spark of young love, and we move on to sort of the compromise attraction of middle age, and then on to something altogether more jeopardized and fragile and more mature when you realize that you know, young love actually needs a considerable amount of work to sustain it. In, you know, the emotionally raw Before Midnight, the most recent film, these characters, however, remain likable despite their flaws, and they're both flawed people who frankly deserve one another. I think that's a safe conclusion to come to by the end of, say, Before Sunset. They've both made mistakes. They're both quick tempered and easily offended by the other, but there's something so remarkable about these extended conversations that these movies essentially are, that you just get lost with their dialogue. And, you know, after three films, you feel like you know them, even though realistically what you've done is you've checked in once every 9 years for one afternoon or evening with this couple. And, you know, of the three, Before Sunset, for some reason, I think is the one I most respond to, because it's the one that's most ambiguous, I guess. They're steadfastly not together. They haven't just met. It's uncertain, and there's something about that uncertainty in the way these two characters dance around it and dance around the question they really want to ask one another in that movie that I really, really find tremendously moving. That's actually my favorite Linklater film, Before Sunset. And I think that this trilogy, in any case, you know, is cumulatively his masterwork.
Great, great pick. I'm glad you did, because I left them off because I'd hoped you would pick them.
I mean, this was almost, honestly, the, to borrow a phrase from Film Spotting, the Jesse and Celine memorial list.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that just seems like the natural inclination.
Yeah, well, for me, this is kind of the Dazed and Confused cast memorial list, and maybe primarily with Wooderson, played right by Matthew McConaughey, who's a great representative of that cast, and I was tempted to include him. But to break that rule, the final choice here for me is from Dazed and Confused. So I'll book in this list, and this is my favorite Richard Linklater movie, and it's this trio, Mike Newhouse, Tony Olsen, and Cynthia Dunn,
nice,
played by Adam Goldberg, Anthony Rapp, and Marissa Ribisi from Dazed and Confused.
I'm just saying, if we're going to go out, we're going to drive around, we should just do something.
Ow. Yeah, you know, you're right, man. I'm just going to, you know, get drunk, maybe get laid, or get in a fight.
No, I'm serious, man. We should be up for anything.
I know, we are. But what? I mean, God, don't you ever feel like everything we do and everything we've been taught is just to service the future?
Yeah, I know. It's like it's all preparation.
Right, but what are we preparing ourselves for?
Death. Life of the party.
It's true. You know, but that's valid. Because if we're all gonna die anyway, shouldn't we be enjoying ourselves now? You know, I'd like to quit thinking of the present, like right now, as some minor, insignificant preamble to something else.
Exactly, man. That's what everybody in this car needs. It's some good old, worthwhile, visceral experience.
And you have these three borderline high school outcasts on this last night of school and first night of summer, arguably the characters with the most promise of any of them in the entire movie. These three people intellectually ahead of the rest of their peers and their more indulgent contemporaries who seemingly have more direction, but find themselves neurotically questioning their futures. And as fun as this movie was and is, a ton of cynicism permeates throughout it. And
thanks, Adam Goldberg.
Yeah, well, from all of the characters. I mean, they're all going through these crises at 18 years old, and you're talking about the Randall Pink Floyd character and also Mitch as he's entering high school and sort of the realities he's facing when it looked like paradise from afar. He gets his ass whipped literally and finds out that it's not going to be rosy, you know, for the rest of high school. But these folks, you have the cynicism that permeates from these young characters with nothing but time and potential ahead of them. And this is such a great trio of people who sort of step outside of it, laugh at it, and the bullies and jocks of their graduating class, soon to be graduating class, but go out and drive around themselves and reach for the good times they see those people having every weekend. And these conversations are just sort of pseudo-intellectual conversations that they're having, even though they're smarter than everybody else you see in this movie. They're just great. And they all have their own arcs too, their moments to themselves, these individual moments. Marissa Ribisi with Matthew McConaughey later in the movie, Adam Goldberg with his feud with Nikki Catt,
which is excellent.
The party at the Moon Tower, and then you have Anthony Rapp's little mini romance with Sabrina, the freshman girl who gets it from Parker Posey and the rest of the, you know, incoming senior class. Those are all really great moments, but I think that their strongest moments are together in their car as they're cruising like everybody else is, and they're talking about, you know, what they want to do with themselves, if they want to go to law school in the future, if the life that their parents and these others expect of them is really what they want to do. It's something that every high schooler faces, to be sure. It's a little more mature than that, perhaps, but I think all of of these actors have great comic timing, and these three have particularly great chemistry. And it's sort of an inside look at this kind of high school student that you don't spend a lot of time with in these high school movies. And I think that Linklater just truly captures the high school experience in Dazed and Confused like nothing I've ever seen in movies. And yeah, that's why it's one of my favorite movies of all time, and perhaps by far my favorite Linklater movie.
Yeah, I mean, I like those characters a lot. There are so many great moments with the three of them, like you said.
I want to dance. I love it.
George Toadweed.
Absolutely, George Toadweed. Are you kidding me, man? He grew fields of that stuff. Yeah.
That does it. That's our Linklater list. And I mean, there are tons of other characters that we could have come up with here, but I think we hit the nail on the head, Corey. I feel good about it.
And I do too.
There's a bunch from Boyhood, too. And again, we encourage you to see that film and enjoy those new characters that'll live on forever in his filmography. And that'll do it for this show. And there's nothing coming out this weekend of note unless you want to see Forrest Gump in IMAX, which I'm sure everybody does.
If you're willing to stay at home, though, to see a movie, God forbid, on Blu-ray and DVD this week, two big recommendations from me. The first, Kelly Reichardt's new eco-thriller, Night Moves, and the second, just like on the other side of the spectrum, David Wayne's very silly comedy, They Came Together. Both really, really good watches.
I'm really in the mood for an eco-thriller, so I'm glad you threw that recommendation out there.
Totally. It's got a great Jesse Eisenberg performance, man.
Can't wait. So those are out. You can catch all of our stuff at aspectradioshow.com. Find us on iTunes. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Aspect Radio. Visit filmnerds.com. You'll find a lot of good stuff, including our friend Ben Stark. He's going to visit Trainspotting soon, and he's going to see Gus Van Sant's Elephant.
Yeah.
So I think those two are coming up on the shelf of shame for Ben Stark.
Two movies I don't particularly like.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I love both of them.
Really?
Especially Trainspotting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a huge fan.
Oh, man, that's too bad.
You can read my stuff at AL.com and Corey's stuff on Tusk205.com. And thanks so much to our producer, Andrew Richardson.
And until next time, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft, and this is Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening. Let
me go. Say, man, you got a joint?
No, not on you, man.
It'd be a lot cooler if you did. Big man,
I just want to fight with you.